This is the fifth of six lectures on world religions, coordinated by the Reverend Michael Schuller of the First Unitarian Universalist Society of Madison, presented at Oakwood Village, starting on October 4th, 2007. For more information about this series of lectures, or about the citywide low-power FM station and its programming, visit citywidelpfm.org.
This is practice of, as I said, a block. This is absolutely ideal conditions. So thank you for coming here and joining us for the fifth, I believe, in the series of presentations on world religions. So it's our privilege today to have Dave Creswell with us. Dave is a member of the First Unitarian Society. He's been a member there for quite a number of years. He's one of the founders of the Madison Insight Meditation Group that has met at First Unitarian Society for quite a number of years. He and I have collaborated on a number of retreats together for members of our congregation. He's very experienced. He's a Buddhist practitioner, and when I've heard him speak about fundamental Buddhism, I'm also impressed. And that's why he's here today. So, Dave Creswell.
Well, thank you. I'm going to talk just briefly today about the teachings of the Buddha. Just briefly, because I want to have a little bit of chance to give you a little taste of some of the practice. And there's just so much. There's so much in the Buddha's teaching. So the Buddha offered much of the same practical advice that Jesus did, and offered it about 500 years earlier. He advised people to pay close attention to what you do and what you say, to live simply, not to harm others, to cultivate compassion and generosity and wisdom. But the teachings of the Buddha, called the Dharma, are actually very different from Christianity in one fundamental aspect, and that is that the teachings of the Buddha are not about believing in anything. Belief is not what gets you there in Buddhism. Rather, they're about spiritual practices for inner transformation. And I believe that this gives them a special relevance to you use, because the teachings of the Buddha are not trying to sell you anything to believe in simply on faith. It's a matter of practices that help you investigate inside. Now, the Buddha started with a deep realization of the inevitability of aging and of sickness and of death. And he found this deep realization quite troubling. He was living in very cushiony, upper-class circumstances 2,500 years ago. He left that life, and he spent the next 6 years wandering around, studying and practicing with the best spiritual teachers of his time and place. And in that time and place, there were some very accomplished spiritual teachers.
Where was this?
This was in northern India. And what the Buddha was striving for was to experience directly the complete and final release from suffering and dissatisfaction. And what he found and what he taught were a set of interdependent and mutually reinforcing spiritual practices. Is everybody hearing okay? Okay, good. So, an interdependent set of mutually reinforcing spiritual practices. not one of them higher than another, but all of them reinforcing each other. And what altogether what they constitute is a program of investigation of suffering and its causes. And this program works us toward a progressive release from suffering and dissatisfaction at deeper and deeper levels of the psyche. And what we find is that as those parts of suffering and dissatisfaction are removed, what's left is a great well of joy and of equanimity and of compassion for others. So just as science is the investigation of deeper and deeper levels of the objective reality out there, Dharma practice, the teachings of the Buddha, is investigation of the subjective reality at deeper and deeper levels of the psyche. Now, probably the most central of these different practices that the Buddha taught is the practice of mindfulness. Mindfulness is not complicated, but it's not easy either. What it is present moment attention, attention to the present moment in each moment. In this moment, this moment, this moment. What is the experience in the moment without judging that experience, without commentary on the experience, and without planning about what comes next. So it's the ability to stay with our experience, not get spun off on some kind of story about the experience, but just be with moment to moment what experience is presenting to us in its most raw sense. And we build this skill really through two means. The first one is through meditation practice, practicing mindfulness in formal meditation. And the second is through the intention to integrate this state gradually into our everyday lives. And this is a long process, because it's one thing to sit with our eyes closed and be mindful. It's another thing to be able to be without judging, without commentary, and without planning in everyday life. Now, of course, there are times when we need to plan for the future. And there are times when it makes sense to relate to present circumstances in terms of things that we recall from the past. And there are times when we need to make judgments. We need to make wise judgments. But what we find with mindfulness meditation is that our minds will do these things compulsively. So even when we're in a situation that doesn't call for us to be judgmental or to be thinking about the future or to be regurgitating the past, that the mind will do that on its own, even if we don't want it to. So mindfulness practice is about learning what the mind does all by itself without our asking it to. And it's about quieting that tendency, for the mind to be chattering when we would like to be focused on what we're experiencing right in the present moment. And what we find is that when the mind is taking us off to regurgitating the past or worrying about the future, that it's taking us away from the joy that can be inherent in the present moment and the wisdom that we can gain by really seeing clearly what is going on. And I'm sure everyone can relate to the experience of recognizing that you were that in the last interval of time that you were kind of on automatic pilot, and that maybe what you did was not as well thought out as you would like. That with benefit of hindsight, you maybe wish that you'd acted with more awareness. And this is one of the aspects of practical life that Dharma practice can help us with through the intentional cultivation of this skill of being mindful of the present moment. And what I would like to do now is I would like to give you an opportunity to do a short mindfulness sitting. And this will be for 10 minutes, and it will not be, it's not something that we can go very deep, of course, but it can give you just a feel for this key practice. So what I suggest is that you put down your pen and get ready to just sit and relax. Pay some attention to your posture. What you want is you want your head erect. You want your spine as upright as it's comfortable for you to have it. Not trying to push yourself to something that isn't comfortable for you. But to have your spine upright, which tends to keep the mind alert. And then letting the body just go limp so that you're holding the spine up, but the spine almost is holding itself up. And you're allowing the body to go limp. If you're comfortable, it's better if you close your eyes. If you're not comfortable, that's certainly not necessary. Feeling then whatever is happening in the body. Not commenting on it, but just feeling. What are the messages, the sensations that the body is sending? Not thinking about them verbally, experiencing them at the level of the sensations themselves. Letting these sensations just come and go, different parts of the body. Watching without commenting or judging. Or if you do judge, not judging the fact that you're judging. The feeling then within the sensations in the body, the sensations associated with the in-breath and the out-breath. Sensations perhaps of the abdomen, or the chest, or the nostrils. not controlling the breath, letting the body breathe in the way that it sees fit, but simply observing this breathing body. It can be useful in order to anchor the attention on the breath to use a very gentle noting of in with the in-breath and out with the out-breath. Keeping most of the attention on the physical sensations, but allowing the noting of in and out to help keep the mind anchored on those sensations. When the mind wanders, as it inevitably does, very gently and without any judging, bringing the attention back to the sensations of the breath, following the breath from the beginning of the in-breath through the end of the in-breath, and then through the duration of the out-breath, keeping the attention alert until the body just naturally breathes again. If some discomfort occurs in the body and seems to take the attention away from the breath, allowing the attention to go to that area of discomfort and inviting the area to relax and release. Feeling perhaps the breath energy going in and out of that area of the body. A kind of energizing with the in-breath and letting go with the out-breath. Keeping the mind alert and the body erect. But then allowing whatever comes into and out of the mind to do so as the body stays relaxed. Allowing the messages, the sensations and thoughts to simply come and go. Being alert to them, but not attaching to anyone. In these last couple of minutes, bringing the attention more exactly at the breath as it goes in and out of the nostrils, with the rest of the body in the background. Keeping alert to each moment of the in-breath, of the out-breath, and of the space in between. Before opening the eyes, setting the intention to maintain some awareness within the body, even as we continue. And then letting the eyes open. So I want to talk about the context of the Buddhist teaching around this core practice of mindfulness. But I thought first that if anyone had any burning question about what we've done so far, including the sitting, that I would maybe entertain a question or two.
I think it would be difficult if you're tired and
underslept. It is more difficult. The question is, would it not be difficult if you're tired and haven't gotten enough sleep to do this? And it is more difficult. I've been to meditation retreats, say, where I haven't had a lot of sleep, and we're meditating all day. But what I find is that over time, the meditation can help you not need as much sleep. And there are also forms of meditation that can help you get to sleep. Yes.
Do most people meditate sitting without anything at their back?
Well, it varies. Do most people do sitting meditation without any back support? I sit on a bench where I don't have back support. But on the other hand, if I want to do a longer sitting, I will sit on a chair that has back support. It varies by individual. Some people will only sit on the cushions. Some people always sit in chairs. If you want the best results, it's good to be having to put some effort into keeping your back and your head erect. But I find that even just keeping my head erect, even if I have something that's supporting my upper back, and then maybe having something supporting it, but not leaning back into it, but using it to support and stay erect. But also, you need to accommodate whatever your physical limitations might be.
Also, what if you have
mild?
Mild pain, I would think you could still meditate, but if the pain were moderate or severe?
The question is, what about if you have moderate or severe pain? And what often happens is, rather than meditating on the breath, you wind up meditating on the sensations in your body. And focusing in so closely on those that you can find that they're different than what you think. And I have experienced that in retreats where I'm sitting for a long time and I start to feel really uncomfortable in my back, and I will sit down and I will say, okay, I'm feeling that in my back, so that is the meditation now. It's not the breath. It's what I'm feeling in the back. And it can ease it considerably. It can even get interesting, because what seemed like this solid pain becomes these varying sensations that are changing all of the time. So we actually can gain insight from looking at physical discomfort with this practice. Yes, sir?
Are these meditation sessions set aside for, say, half an hour or an hour every day, or is there any system? Because, and also I want to ask about the environment around. We have a little summer cottage up at the lake.
Mm-hmm.
We've got 94. People are driving 100 miles an hour or more. And you got to keep your wits about you. And it's a decision. You turn your head away, let them go around, there's a truck right behind me. And yet when we get up to the lake, I get out of the pier with an easy chair.
Mm-hmm.
And meditate.
Yeah.
yourself, or whether that's the same thing or not. But you start forgetting some of your problems because of your environment.
Yes.
I just wanted to get one of the Buddhists has to have a time and a place, because he's certainly got to eat, he's got to work, he must have to mow the lawn, do all these things.
Well, I take time out of each day to meditate.
For how long?
I do an hour sitting each day, and sometimes another sitting. Other people that are in this group take less, they have less time. I'm fortunate to be retired and able to do that. So there's an advantage to doing it that way. And then the other question that you had was the question of if your environment simply allows you to relax, like your cabin up north, is that pretty much the same as meditation? Is that a... Yeah. And it is... It certainly helps. getting away where you don't have the demands on you is very useful. And for me, going to meditation retreats is going to a place where I don't have demands on me. A question can be, when you get to that place that there are no demands on you and you sit down in that comfortable chair, what's happening in the mind? And meditation is an investigation of what's happening in the mind. And it can be a wonderful thing to do up at a cabin. What I think a lot of people will do, and it's very pleasurable, is daydream while they're up there. And if you're daydreaming, are you really taking in this beautiful environment you're in? Or is your mind somewhere else? Mindfulness practice helps build the skill of being up there and being 100% with this beautiful environment, if that's what you're choosing. But I'm not about to poo-poo the advantages of simply getting away and having time without demands. Yes?
Does anyone meditate in siesta to try to make oneself free?
There is a kind of meditation called the body scan, which I use at times. If I wake up in the middle of the night, and it seems, well, I tend to wake up once or twice, but if I wake up and it feels like I'm going to have some trouble getting back to sleep, then there's a practice called the body scan, where you move mindfulness through your whole body that I find very useful in getting back to sleep. It's very relaxing to the body, it's very relaxing to the mind, and because it's both of those, it will tend you, even if I don't get back to sleep, I know I'm getting deep rest. And then ironically, because I know that even if I don't get back to sleep, I'm getting deep rest, I have less anxiety about whether I'm going to get back to sleep. So yeah, that is one advantage certainly that I've gleaned from mindfulness practice. Yes. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. The advantage of meditating seated upright is that the erect spine tends to give a message to the brain of it's time to be alert now. And in meditation, ideally what we're getting at is relaxation and alertness together, so that the mind is relaxed, but we're also alert of what's happening. But meditating laying down is certainly possible. Yes, ma'am?
It sounds like the brain is separate from your person. As if you're working on your brain as if it's not part of you, but a separate entity. Is that right?
that's a bigger question than the and I'll get to that a little in what I'm talking about. The Dharma practice works on habits of the mind. Habits of the mind that we have that tend to make us want things to be different than they are, that tend to lead us to a self-centeredness and then lead us to judge ourselves about that. And so we are working on the tendencies of the mind, but of course when you say we, the mind is a big part of that. Certainly there's no philosophical stance that there's a you separate from the brain in this. In fact, really, the Buddha didn't teach philosophical stances. He said those are not useful. What's useful is to investigate what's in our experience. I don't know if that is a satisfactory answer. Well, let me talk a little about the context of all of the practices, and then we can come back to more questions. So, skillful mindfulness is a key part of Dharma practice, but it fits in a context of other parts too. And what Dharma practice really starts with is intention. In fact, the Buddha said that's what karma is, it's intention. So we want to have skillful intentions. And the intentions that the Buddha invites us to experiment with, he's not saying this is the right thing to do, he's saying try it. Try it and see if it works. Is the intention towards simplicity and generosity, the intention toward loving kindness, a kind of universal love, and the intention toward not harming. Not harming people, not harming animals. Which is really minimizing the harm that we do. And then he expands upon that in what he calls the precepts. What Thich Nhat Hanh calls the mindfulness trainings. And these are things that we try to do in our everyday life. It's not like the Ten Commandments. It's not somebody telling you, you should do this, but rather it's an invitation to see if these don't help in our spiritual progress. The first one is to not harm other beings. The second one is to not take what is not freely given, to not steal. And we might even say, using too much in resources, are we taking from future generations? So there's a lot to these, and I have to just gloss over them because of the amount of time we have. Then there's what he calls skillful speech. Not to speak harshly, not to speak divisively, and that's referring kind of to gossip, where you're talking about someone else who's not there, and you're feeling, gosh, you're feeling closer to the person you're talking about at the expense of someone else. The third is not to speak so as to deceive. And this isn't just, well, I didn't literally lie. The question is, did you have the intention to deceive in what you said? And if you had that intention, then that creates effects in the mind that will persist. And finally, the last part of skillful speech is to avoid idle chatter, that just sort of dissipates the attention and habituates us to act on impulse. So to be careful in the speech, to speak things that are useful, to speak things that are true, that are useful, and that are timely. The fourth is to refrain from sexual misconduct. And the Buddha is not a moralist, or was not a moralist in terms of premarital sex, but you do not engage in sexual conduct that harms someone else. So clearly, adultery or inviting someone else to commit adultery is sexual misconduct. Anything where you're using sexual energy in a harmful way. And then the final one is the use of intoxicants that cloud the mind. And of course, the reason for that is you're apt to break all the other precepts if you use intoxicants to the point that they cloud the mind. So these actions, the right intention and the right, and these precepts help to free the mind from regret, from anxiety, and really set us up so that we're more able to do the meditation. And then the kinds of meditation that are really core to the Buddha's teaching are the mindfulness meditation that we just did a little short sample of, loving kindness meditation, which is almost like secular prayer. It's where you're wishing good for yourself and for other people in a meditative process. And it's a very powerful process for reconditioning the mind from resentment and other negative emotional states. And then there's the concentration practices where you really learn to concentrate on the breath. And this is a practice that can bring tremendous relaxation and joy. But the purpose of that ultimately is to lead to insights that really free us from suffering, that kind of pull the suffering up by the roots. And the insights, the wisdom part of the path, first of all, we gain psychological insights. And I have had myself some effects from that that I've been just very, very grateful for, of working through psychological issues that at a deep level that I had never contacted before. And then you look at what are called the three universal characteristics. First of all, that things are changing all the time. And we can know that intellectually, but through Dharma practice, we know it at a deeper and deeper level, so that we're able at a deeper and deeper level to let go of the desire for things to be constant. The second is unreliability. Recognizing that although some things can be relatively reliable, ultimately there is no reliability. And ironically, I mean, this sounds very negative, but ironically, when we realize those things at a deeper and deeper level, the effect is more joy. Because we're not trying to grab on to things that can't ultimately be held on to. We are able to let go at a deeper and deeper level. Let go of greed, let go of aversion, of wanting to push things away, and to let go of delusion, to let go of kind of this picture of how we think things are that maybe we haven't been able to really investigate at a deep level. So I find the practice of the Dharma to be extremely useful. As a Unitarian Universalist, I've been doing this for 12 years, and never having considered myself very spiritual, I now find myself really very excited about this, and very excited about helping other people get a taste of it. So I'm going to take more questions, but also we're going to pass around a sign-up sheet. And if anyone is interested in coming together for, I think, maybe 4 sessions where you learn more about actually doing these practices, then if you would sign your name and put a phone number on, then if there's sufficient interest, I'll be working to set up a group where we can really look at these practices on more than the very superficial level that we have time for here. So, questions? Yes.
What's the main difference between meditating and daydreaming?
What is the main purpose between meditating and daydreaming? In meditation, we are staying with the bare experience of what's happening and watching that experience change moment after moment. In daydreaming, we're forgetting where we are for the moment and we're thinking about the future or the past or some fantasy or some combination. So they are actually very different. And to praise meditating is not to condemn daydreaming. It's just that it's a different activity. Yes.
As we travel through Thailand and other places, we see these golden statues of Buddha. What kind of difference do they have? Is it an organized church?
Well, the Buddha's teaching has been around for 2,500 years. So there's a wide variety of cultures that it's been in, and there's a wide variety of approaches. The approach that I follow and that's quite popular in the West would say that the statues of the Buddha are a reminder to us that there was someone who figured this out all on his own and can be an inspiration to us to practice very assiduously. So if you look at a statue of a Buddha statue, he's sitting there, he's serene, he's open to whatever is going on. So I find that, in spite of the fact that I have never had any affinity for religious icons, I find that at times as an aid in the kind of serenity that I'm wanting to practice. So does that...
Is there a group that meets together at regular times?
There are several groups in town that meet together at regular times. And I don't have one of them meets at the Unitarian Church on Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock. On this sheet that's going around, if you would also make note of your interest in other groups in town, then I will make sure that you get a list of those other groups. I didn't actually bring copies of that today. Yeah, Howard.
What does this do for me to have a better life in the future?
I'll tell you what, I'll answer... I'm sorry, I thought you were still holding this... No. It's so varied and so individual. I can speak for myself. What it has done for me is it took me from a point of being, of manifesting anger, of being a little bit angry quite often, to lessening that considerably. I started doing this, and within a handful of months, both my teenage son and my wife commented on the radical reduction in my anger. And I wasn't abusive or anything. I was in a job that was really stressful, and I expressed irritation in a non-threatening way. And they said, that has just been reduced tremendously. It can be good for your health. It reduces stress. There's a whole, at the University of Wisconsin Medical Center, there's a whole medical program called mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is based on mindfulness meditation to reduce stress, and doctors are prescribing that for their patients and sending them there. It has made me more aware of other people's feelings. It's just, I don't know, it's so comprehensive, it's hard, it's hard for me to answer that, you know, with the breadth that your question really calls for. Do you have a follow-up question from what I've said?
Well, I guess my problem then is, what do I mean by having a better life?
Yes. These are a handful of the many things that have made me feel like I have a better life. And that's really all I can offer. I could go into more detail, but I want to make sure other people have a chance to come to the class. You'll find out a lot more. Yes, sir.
Is there a Buddhist organization somewhere?
We have an organization at the Unitarian Church. We have meetings every Sunday evening. But it's mostly practice and talk about the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha. We have a newsletter, but it's talking about the retreats that we offer.
Well, my question is, internationally, is there something?
Oh, there are a lot of things. One of them is the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, which is people in the different schools of Buddhism working for peace and for those things that support peace, like environmental sustainability and economic justice and that sort of thing. Yeah.
I think the basic question has to do with the issue. There are so the myriad of forms of Buddhism. There's Nisha, Shishu, pure Buddhism. There's recent Kosakai. There's the traditions associated with Tibetan Buddhism. Mm-hmm. So there's no single Unitarian international movement. There are many, many Buddhists spread out all over the world.
Yeah.
There are many, many Christian denominations.
Yeah, okay, thank you, Michael. Yeah, maybe that is that more what you were looking for?
Yes.
Yes, okay, thank you. Yes. Yes, there's a yes, there is a researcher. The question is there a group of, and I'm saying yes, there is a group. So I'm repeating the question in the answer. There is a group at University of Wisconsin headed up by Richie Davidson, who is internationally known for researching the different health benefits and psychological benefits of meditation. And there's a lot of studies in that field. Five to four. Yes.
You had talked about the UW integrative medicine program and the mindfulness-based
program.
And in my answer, a couple of people's questions regarding the goals to that. It's referred to by physicians for people who have cancer. Some people who have chronic pain issues, fibromyalgia, chronic hives, all the way to some other psychological issues that are prescribed by the psychologist. So that is looked at by a lot of people, let alone everyday people who want to, like you said, let go of it.
And a lot of people who go through that program then wind up hooking up with us or one of the other meditation groups in town and simply making this part of their lives. Yes, sir.
How do you turn off your mind? Even when you're asleep, your mind is at work with that dream.
Well, the closest that I know of turning off the mind is in some of these deep states of concentration where the mind isn't so much turned off as it is, say, concentrated on the feeling of equanimity or on the feeling of contentment. So there's nothing verbal happening in the mind. There's simply a focus on equanimity or contentment. But that's actually more a means toward an end, believe it or not, than an end in itself. Yes.
How do you balance equanimity with bad news, the upset in the world?
I wish we could stay another hour for me to just talk about that, because that's something that that I think of a lot, because we live in a world, I mean, this century, things that are apt to happen this century, it is of deep concern to me. And I justify my Dharma practice, rather than being out being politically active, by the fact that if we're going to save this world, then people in this country are going to have to be able to let go of greed, of aversion. We're going to have to let go of the idea that our absolute security is more important than peace and the poor in the third world countries. So the practice, I think, in this practice, you are building within yourself what is going to have to be built within people in this country. And in that, I feel that I'm very much allied with many of the liberal Christian groups trying to do the same thing, saying we need a spiritual solution or we need spiritual foundation for the solution to war, to environmental degradation, to economic injustice. Does that answer?
I think it's unanswerable.
Yeah, it would be great to just go back and forth on that. Yes. Yes, and I do some political activism too. The question is, when you're doing political activism, are you doing it out of anger, or are you doing it out of compassion? And I know this is very simplistic to, you know, go black or white, but are you doing it out of compassion? Compassion not only for the victims, but compassion for the perpetrators. One Tibetan monk who had been tortured by the Chinese was interviewed by the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama said, did you ever feel that you were really in danger when you were being tortured? And the monk said, there was a time that I felt that I was in danger. I was in danger of losing my compassion for my torturers. Now, that was a man that didn't have any power to act. But had he had the power to act, he would have acted, but he would have acted from compassion. I see you're suffering, but I need to stop you because you're causing more suffering. I don't know that I'm ultimately there, by the way. Other questions? Okay, well, we're right on time. Thank you very much for your attention.